Nirvana deep cut, David? Or, I mean, this isn't one of their more well-known tunes. I might have gone with All Apologies or Smells Like Teen Spirit would be kind of a cliche, but Sliver, right?
Yeah,
that's this track. Well, Friday marked 30 years since Kurt Cobain committed suicide, but it was this day, April 8th, 1994, when the musician's body was found and the bad news spread from Seattle all around the world. With a look back at that tragic day is our resident historian, Felix Banal. Felix, thanks for joining us this morning.
Yeah, yeah. That song is Sliver. That's generally regarded by a lot of people as in the top three all-time Nirvana songs.
Well, there you go. What do I know?
It's one definitely my favorite song, and one that captures that whole era better than just about anything else in the whole catalog. You know, the coverage on Friday was sort of, I was kind of weird because that was the day that he committed suicide, and it was 3 days later that they found his body. I thought it was weird that the anniversary was being observed on the day that he committed suicide. That's just from a personal standpoint, because it was a Friday back in 1994. I was working here in Seattle. I was working at the Chamber of Commerce. We didn't have email. We had internal email. We didn't have external email. So the word sort of spread around the office late that morning. I can't remember who it was who came and told me. I felt the blood draining out of my face. Part of it, I mean, the story's personal for me just because, you know, think about great artists or celebrities who have passed away in my lifetime. And I'm 55 years old, so I've been paying attention for the last 50 years or so. Kurt Cobain was the guy who felt like demographically was just like me. I mean, he's about a year and a half older than I was, than I am. That whole scene in Seattle in the 80s around music and culture where we were sort of an up-and-coming place because of the bands that were coming out of here, but it wasn't mainstream. It's so easy to forget that until Smells Like Teen Spirit was released to radio in August of 1991, that music was just, there's nothing like that being played on the radio. It was all very much, you know, it was Madonna and all these sort of very kind of mainstream pop that stretched back to, you know, the 1960s even, if you look at the Beatles in the 70s and the 80s and 90s. So I still remember vividly, I was working at Cairo in 1991 when I first heard Smells Like Teen Spirit on the radio driving home. I was living at my parents' house in Kirkland. I was 22. 91, I was 22. But the sound, I remember hearing it coming on KNDD. That was like the de facto grunge station in those days, the Seattle Sound Station. And I'm coming up the hill and just like, it was like I'd heard everything that I knew and loved about this area, not the rest of the world, all encapsulated in a single song. All like, there it all is. And I remember stopped in the driveway, just sat in the driveway in my Ford Escort, listening to the music play and thinking, whoa, this is like, something's changed. I'm feeling a tingle in the back of my neck hearing myself talk about it. I don't know what anyone else thinks. But so when the news broke that day, it was kind of a mixture of personal and I didn't know Kurt Cobain. I met him a few times at a mutual friend, and I hung out at his apartment in, I don't know, November of 1990 before they became huge. And it was just sort of like, I mean, my most vivid memory, I didn't even talk to Kurt that much that night. I talked to another musician who was there who went on to become very famous, who was trying to get me to go back to her apartment to look at her encyclopedia collection. We were talking about old books and stuff. Wow. So I wasn't really paying much attention to Kurt. I was paying attention to this. Anyway, that's a whole other story. But I mean, this is, you know, I was 22? Yeah. So this is a long time ago. But at that evening there in Olympia in 1990, my most vivid memory is when we were leaving, Kurt loaned my pal Jeff his VHS copy of H.R. Puff and Stuff. You know, because Kurt was 23. Everyone was just kids. I mean, even 27 when
and
he died, still so
like,
young.
The grungy, angsty, ripped jeans, you know, unwashed hair, all of that. He was, because, you know, I'm a huge Dave Grohl fan.
Yeah, yeah.
He's my guy in Foo Fighters. And so he'll still, you know, you'll hear stories about, he was a funny.
Yep, right.
He loved to laugh. He was engaging and friendly. His music was dark, but he wasn't. But then he got into drugs, and it turned him dark, obviously. Yeah. But he was a very happy-go-lucky, fun guy.
Yeah, and that song, Sliver, we heard at the top, that's all about a kid who has to go to his grandparents' house while his parents go out, and he doesn't want to eat his meat, and he falls asleep watching TV and wakes up in his mother's arms. And then the refrain is, Grandma, take me home. Grandma, take me home. That's why I love that song. So anyway, this is the last big celebrity death before the internet really rose. I mean, that's why I heard about it from another person. I went home that night. We were going to a party up on Queen Anne Hill where we lived, and I didn't have internet access at home. I couldn't log on to my AOL account. But I remember sitting around watching TV with people that night. And then the Seattle Times that afternoon published that just it's a photo of taken with a telephoto lens looking into the open doorway of that above the garage.
Didn't it show his feet or something?
You see his foot, you see his arm, you see a cigar box and stuff. There's an investigator kneeling down, taken by a great Seattle Times photographer named Tom Reese. It generated a lot of controversy, but I think the verdict, a lot of people thought, was like, that showed the grimness. That showed there's the worst of the worst. If you're a drug addict and if you don't get help and if all things goes to hell, that's what it looks like. And it was sort of, I think generally the Times was applauded for doing that. Maybe not applauded, but they weren't as, it was controversial, put it that way. But it was that kind of event. It played out on TV and newspaper. And then on that following Sunday, there was a big memorial event, public event at International Fountain at Seattle Center. I went to that. We took the monorail. It was the only two celebrity things I've been to were that Kurt Cobain thing at the International Fountain and the John Lennon thing 14 years earlier, also at the International Fountain.
So the more time that passes by, you know, famous people's legacies change over time, or they have a tendency to. Do you think Kurt Cobain's enduring legacy is the same as it was 10 years after his passing as it is now 30 years after his passing?
Yeah, the music is still great, and for me it still represents this era. Seeing like a skinny guy from the Northwest in a car, like an old cardigan and a t-shirt and ripped jeans, that was like me and my friends for all the 80s. It was like, it's like it felt like everything about the Northwest that I knew and loved and I thought would never be known around the world all of a sudden became this worldwide thing.
And the influence is still there. I mean,
absolutely.
Popular
yep.
stores like Target, they'll sell the Nirvana shirts and yeah. you see young kids wearing it. Yeah. I actually ran into, she was probably 12, wearing a Nirvana shirt when we were in London 2 years ago for the Taylor Hawkins tribute concert,
see?
Which, you know, Taylor Hawkins, Dave Grohl, all that. And I asked her and she's like, oh, I just love this. Like the music
will never go away.
Any angsty 12, 13,
yeah,
14.
You're right.
When you hear those notes, you go, this is my jam right now.
Yeah, it's
I
a
think
soft
it's
power.
Absolutely.
It's a soft power of the Northwest and a guy whose life ended very prematurely and sadly, but we have this music and these stories to kind of parse and think about. It goes on forever.
Felix Bonnell, thanks so much for joining Seattle's Morning News. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
All right, let's talk about the economy with CBS business analyst Jill Schlesinger. Jill, the deadline to file your taxes is fast approaching. Do you have some last-minute tax tips to get everything squared away before tax day?
Now, of course, this is not for you. I know that you've already done this. You were probably one of those early filers. I can tell already just by the
Jill,
sound of your voice.
You know what? Full confession here on this Monday morning. Mm. I'm about halfway through my taxes. I've had some people do them in the past. And I've also done them myself this year. I've opted for a professional to do it. So
okay. All right. As long as you're attending to that. I mean, for everyone who's thinking about filing right now with just a week to go, the most efficient way to get this done is to go to the IRS website, irs.gov, and use e-file, electronic filing. It's the safest, quickest way to submit your returns. Now, if you've got adjusted gross income of 79 grand or less, you can use free file. This is kind of a cool way to do it because you'll be able to file your returns at no extra cost with through electronic fillable forms or through IRS partnerships with private tax prep services. So these are two good ways to get it done. And, you know, for most people, you're claiming the standard deduction, you're entering in your information. You can do this with a week to go. There shouldn't be a huge problem for you.
So, like I said, in the past, I've done my taxes on my own through a website called TurboTax. I've also used H&R Block. Is it just my imagination and is it just anecdotal? But I feel like 1 year when I used a tax professional, all of a sudden they came back and said, hey, you don't owe anything this year. You're good to go. And then when I do it myself, I feel like I'm owing a lot of cash at the end of the year. Is that because they're just finding stuff within my finances that I can write off? Or is that just kind of a one-off deal?
I don't know. I mean, I'd have to look at your specific return, which
right.
we will be happy to post on your website, I'm sure,
for
everyone to see. Right. But I think sometimes it's just being methodical because often when people go through and complete their returns late in the cycle, they'll miss some opportunities. Not because you know, there's someone finding something. It's just that you're rushing through the process. So maybe, you know, for example, the IRS has said to me, like, when you're going on the air, please remember to tell people to put in the correct dependent information. And also make sure that if they have kids that qualify for the child tax credit, that they check the box. So it could be simply that people who are at the very end of the process are rushing through and they're not getting what they deserve simply because there's too much going on and they're freaked out a little bit.
So for people that end up owing money when they file their taxes, are there payment options available for people or is it all owed as a lump sum right by April 15th?
Well, there are many options because the IRS knows that not everybody is sitting on top of a big pile of money in their bank account. They know that there are various things that are coming up for you. So there are a few different ways to pay. Now, if you do have money that is sitting in a bank account or investment account, you can actually make a one-time payment through the IRS Direct Pay portal. So this is very easy. You can pay your taxes securely. You can go straight from your checking or savings account. No fees, no registration, no nothing. Okay, so that's that. But if you have a longer term problem, you don't have the money, there are a few ways the IRS wants to help you out. Let's go from the longest term to the shortest term. A long term payment plan is basically an installment plan. So if you owe 50 grand or less in tax, penalties, interest, you can have a monthly installment plan for up to 5 years. Mm. This is great because you get it set up, the money gets pulled out of your bank account, it goes to the IRS, and the plan will actually work for you. Okay, this is very easy. $31 to set it up as long as you have it connected to a bank account. There's also a short-term payment plan. This is for people who owe less than $100,000 in tax penalties and interest. You can get this right at the IRS website, online payment agreement application. And the IRS usually will grant you up to an extra 6 months, 180 days to pay the bill. This is very good news for people who might be like, maybe I'm entitled to a bonus, but it doesn't come in for a month or two. So a short-term payment plan can really work. And then there's the worst, and I hate this. I hate the IRS doing this, but you can actually pay an outstanding tax bill with a credit card. This is terrible. An expensive way to pay your taxes. There are fees associated with using your card. And by the way, of course, there is the risk that if you don't pay off your credit card bill on a month-to-month basis, that that IRS tax that you've paid on your credit card will cost you way more in the future because of the interest associated with the credit card companies. So please avoid credit card use. Use one of these IRS plans. They're really much better.
Jill, consumer spending seems strong. The job market is doing great. The economy is growing. But I read today that a surge in oil prices could be the number one threat to the economy. Do you agree? And for lack of a better term, what is fueling that increase in price per barrel, which is quickly approaching $90?
Well, I mean, look, it's not great when we have a oil spike. I think that most of the economists that I speak to say that if oil stays under 100, we should be able to absorb it. Okay. But you're absolutely right that it could pose a risk and that you could have oil prices rise. And then all of a sudden that increase filters through to other parts of the economy. Now, we're going to get a consumer price index report. It's going to come out on Wednesday of this week. And we're going to see that we've moved backwards, that the CPI will rise at the headline level. What we're looking for in this report, though, is underneath that headline, what else is going on? Are prices going down in all the other categories? Because it is true that, yeah, it's a bummer when you fill up your car, but the U.S. household, the average household, is not spending as much on oil and crude oil of their total budget as they once did, say, 30, 40 years ago. So if we stay under 100, I think we're okay. If the Middle East war does not escalate and start to curtail oil production, we should be okay. It's just a drag when you're filling up your car.
Looking ahead to the presidential election in 2024, I'm reminded of that famous James Carville quote about voter priorities where he said it's the economy, stupid, in 1992. Does that still ring true some 30 plus years later? Or do you think in a Biden versus Trump rematch, is it a priority of personalities over pocketbook?
Well, I have to say a fascinating survey came out last week from the Wall Street Journal. And that survey found that when people were asked about what's going on in the economy, they were wrong. They were just flat out wrong. And so what's weird about that is that you would say, oh, it's the economy, stupid, but it's not actually coming through in that way, meaning that even when you look at the Wall Street Journal people who are responding to this, so you'd think, oh, the Wall Street Journal people, they're going to be, you know, more attuned to financial stuff. Yes and no, because even the thing that is you know, unequivocally provable. Hey, are prices going up or down? People say they're going up still. They're not. The inflation rate's coming down. Prices are still high. And you say, hey, has the stock market gone up or down? They say it's gone down. Well, it's gone up. So I don't know what to make of this, my friends, except to say that we're crazy. Just in general, as human beings. And if you want to look at this more closely, you know, again, it's a New York Times, a Wall Street Journal article, and it's economic data versus consumer feelings. That's really what it's coming down to. And it's quite fascinating to me. I don't understand it. And yet I also don't want to be the person who says, like, I don't care how you feel. You're wrong. Because that's how people feel.
That is CBS business analyst Jill Schlesinger. Thank you so much, Jill.
Take care.
Time for your daily dose of kindness, brought to you by Heritage Homecraft. When you're feeling wonder, you're feeling life at its absolute best. And that's why a lot of people climb mountains or dive into oceans. But sometimes that wonder comes to us, like it will this morning for millions across the country. For a look at the wonder at the solar eclipse, here's CBS's Steve Hartman.
A 9-year-old boy is about to have the greatest experience of his little lifetime. A kid so into astronomy, he takes his planet book to swimming lessons. Dressed up as the solar system for Halloween, and made his third grade New Year's resolution to get a shrewd idea of how the multiverse could be real.
It's basically a theory about having not one, but an infinite number of universes.
And you'd like to understand it better?
Yeah, which I already have done.
This is George.
Would you explain it to me someday?
I will.
It's like living in an astrophysics lecture hall.
Like dark matter is holding them together.
Okay, I'm out of here.
We all laugh about it. But it's also been a marvel to witness. See, George is autistic, and one of the many blessings of his autism is this ability, shared by many like him, to find overwhelming joy in the most underwhelming minutia.
By a strange coincidence, the moon is 400 times smaller than the sun, but 400 times closer to the Earth.
Where's the sun now?
Given all that, we made a road trip to central Nebraska, found a nice lady who let us use her farm, and waited with the locals.
Is this everything you ever dreamed?
It was the perfect setting.
Not me.
Perfect, at least, for most of us. And as the moon made its way to stardom, I saw something truly marvelous.
Dad, it's so cool.
So much of parenting is saying no and forcing vegetables. But on rare occasion, the heavens align, and you're in the perfect position to feed a passion.
1% left? Oh my God, it's so dark.
I know a lot of people looked up and saw something remarkable that day.
Look up there!
But for mothers and fathers like me, the more beautiful sight was looking over at the reaction of our precious earthlings.
Oh my.
And that was CBS's Steve Hartman.
Now joining us from the G and Ursula show, which you can hear from 9 to noon right here on Cairo Radio, Ursula Royteen. Hi, Ursula.
Yeah,
long
good
time.
Morning.
No talk on the air. It's been a while. Great to see you.
Great
my
to
friend.
See you, too.
Awesome. Thanks
well,
for being here.
Early for you.
No. I'm up at 3:30 a.m. daily, usually. Depends on what show I'm working on on any given day.
True.
But
that's true.
Ursula, I saw this article recently from the Washington Post titled, "As the Internet Gets Scarier, More Parents Keep Their Kids' Photos Offline." So apparently, sharenting is out, privacy is in. I've noticed a bit of a long overdue awakening when it comes to how we wield these smartphones that are ubiquitous in this day and age. There's an abundance now of research and data available about what these glowing rectangles are doing to us on an individual level and even at a societal level. So do you think this sort of raised awareness has been a good thing? And do you celebrate this trend where people are keeping more personal photos, especially of their kids, offline and maybe just more for, you know, close friends and interpersonal relationships and immediate family members via text?
When I read articles like this, I feel very guilty about my own parenting and what I have done on social media with my children.
Okay.
Because Chris is nodding his head. I have been very open with sharing my family on social media, perhaps too open, probably very much like what I do on the show, which is to share my life.
Sure.
And
I respect people who decide that they're going to keep their kids offline or are going to do everything they can to protect their kids' privacy. I'm not going to say that I did that. I understand. Now, when I started Facebook, and Facebook is my go-to, you know, so my kids didn't mind that I shared on Facebook because they never looked at it. They're like, that's for old people in their mind. But when they got old enough to say, Mom, I knew the pictures that they would be okay with. And if I had any question, I would ask them. And on occasion, my younger son, who is a more private, would say, could you remove that? I mean, that one's embarrassing. I'd rather not have that. But I know now that there are things that creeps are going to do with your kids' pictures if they want. And it's hard to protect from everything that is out there on the internet. So I appreciate that people do that, but that's not how I did it.
Well, and I don't think anyone can fault you or others or even me for an abundance of posting in the early days of social media, for example, because we didn't know. And I think it's been true throughout human history. When there's a technological advancement, we seem to just rush into it headlong and just look at the positive sides to it and think, we'll only use this for good and only good things can come of this. But now, you know, I think Steve Jobs introduced the iPhone in like 2007 or 2009 or something like that. Twitter came along about the same time. So we have about 15 years now we can look back and study. So none of us can be blamed for a certain level of naivete. And furthermore, the landscape has changed vastly in those 15 years. I mean, the advancement of AI.
Yeah.
Now, if you have a picture of your kid online, someone in Photoshop could, you know, chop the head off and put it on a different body.
The Washington State Lottery just did that to a woman.
That's right.
Just last week, her face was put on a topless picture of an AI piece of art. And, you know, if they can do it with adults, then certainly it can happen with kids.
Well, and so one thing we're telling our 13-year-old is, you know, when you're out with friends, we know all of them have smartphones, but if you're going to get your picture taken in any situation, just know the internet is forever and they can use that picture for whatever purposes they see fit once it's out there on the World Wide Web. We're not trying to like instill this deep fear in them, but we just want to raise the consciousness level of what's going on.
And I think that is really good and that is really healthy. I also know that for my family, and I have family all over the world, you know, some of the social media posts were a way to keep everybody. And you know, it's the positive parts that, unfortunately, because there are so many gross people who want to do terrible things to these pictures, that you have to be much more aware. And I think that's healthy. I love that. Just real quick, I had a coworker. I took some pictures at a party of mine. And the coworker said, hey, could you take off the pictures of my kids? And I liked that. It was like, you know what?
Yeah.
Great.
Right.
No problem.
Welcome back to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Colleen O'Brien, along with Chris Sullivan and Greg Tomlin, who's filling in for Dave Ross today. On Monday, we bring you Crime and Punishment, our check each week with Casey McNerthney from the King County Prosecutor's Office. And Casey, I like to begin with good news. So let's get some good news out of Olympia.
Yeah, so this is last week we talked about the catalytic converter bill and how that was passed and signed by the governor. There's also a bill, 1493. It was a House bill, and that affects DUIs. And there really, there was five different bills that Amy Friedheim, who's the head of our felony traffic unit, has been working on for years and advocating for. Those were wrapped into one, into this bill, 1493. One of the things that it does is if you get a first-time DUI, it gives you the option of substance abuse treatment, because a lot of people that we see who get DUIs are people who have an alcohol or drug issue. Mm-hmm. And trying to get the root of that problem rather than just dealing with the DUI on its own is a good way to go. So this bill is an option for that. And then there's also the question too about, you know, what about the people who don't stop? How does this bill address that? And here's Amy explaining that.
This also extends what we call our look back. The main people who are becoming felony DUIs are people who have their fourth DUI offense in 10 years. And this extended it to 15 years. So there's a longer period of time that we are looking back. And this is going to capture more people who are driving impaired and who are the most dangerous people on the road, who continually drive impaired and holding them accountable.
I think I've always been confused why we allow, you know, I know we've reduced the number of DUI convictions before. I think a felony conviction, is it 3 or 5 this time? I feel like they moved the needle on that. And I thought, gosh, I'm more of a one strike, you're out person. Right. I don't understand how anybody tolerates 3 DUIs before extreme punishment.
And surprisingly, it does happen more often than you think.
Yeah.
And that's something I'm sure if you asked Amy, she's also pushing for the legal limit to be
lowered.
Lower than 0.08.
And I've heard for and against that.
Yeah.
I have heard some pretty compelling arguments against lowering the limit. I think it's from 0.08 to 0.05.
Right. That's right.
But there's a lot of pushback to that, surprisingly.
Yeah. And, you know, I didn't really get it until I realized how actually hard it is to get to 0.08. You know, which maybe that's me talking to Amy and having a different perspective, but it's really surprising. There was a New Year's Eve party probably a decade ago where somebody had a breathalyzer and we all were just trying it out. Like, not like the cops would have, but one that did the same thing. And I was surprised. It actually was pretty hard to get up there.
You're like, hey, I've had enough where I feel like I shouldn't drive. And yet.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Yeah. Well, it's good news that at least in King County, DUIs, they're getting tougher on DUIs and at least offering treatment options, it sounds like.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And then there's also something where it strengthens the requirements around ignition interlock devices too. What's also interesting is there's a part of this bill that also addresses people who are high when they're driving and how you can test for that. Here's a clip of Amy explaining what that does.
It also has a special program that we are looking into that the State Patrol is going to do. It's a saliva test for drugs. And it's a non-invasive roadside test for drug impairment. And so when police are stopping cars, we have to see if this test is adequate and if this gives us good information for drug impaired drivers. Because right now, if police suspect that you are driving under the influence of drugs, the only way to test for that is to draw your blood, which is fine. Police can get a search warrant to draw the blood, but it would be nice if we have something less invasive than the needle that gives us accurate information. So one of the components of this bill is to test this program for non-invasive drug impaired driving.
Do we know the accuracy of a saliva test for marijuana?
We're waiting to find out about that and also see how well it works and also what the courts do with it too. So we'll see how that goes.
Sure. Yeah. Can somebody refuse a saliva test on the side of the road?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm not sure.
All right.
Yeah.
We'll keep watching that. Now we have a few updates. One out of Bellevue. We've had a lot of fleeing drivers, a lot of police chases out there lately.
It feels like we're in LA for a bit.
I know.
Yeah.
I don't like it. It's dangerous.
No kidding. Yeah. There's a case out of Bellevue where we asked for the driver in that case to be held on a high bail. The court set that at $500,000. We anticipate getting that case from Bellevue today for a charging decision. So we'll keep you posted on that.
Okay. How do you decide when to enact a high bail and when a lower bail is adequate?
It really depends on 3 things. The first is if somebody's likely to interfere with the case if released. Also, if they're likely to not return to court. Mm-hmm. And the biggest one that's most often argued is if there's a danger to public safety. And so if you can go to court and say, if this person's released, here's why we think it's a public safety risk. And then showing the evidence of why we think that to the court. And then the defense has a chance to say, no, here's why. Often they ask for release on personal recognizance. And then it's up to the courts to say, okay, I've weighed both sides. Here's what my ruling is.
Okay. And that leads me to a question that over the past week we've had here in the newsroom and a few listeners have also asked, given the news right now, which is, you know, a separate case, one out of Snohomish County, which is the mother who is alleged to have killed her 4-year-old son, dumped his body on the side of the road. Her bail was set really, I think it was $5 million. And then we have this 18-year-old driver who's allegedly totaled 3 cars in the last 11 months. And then in the latest case, allegedly killed this mother and 3 children in a crash, bail set at $100,000.
Yeah.
Why?
Well, what prosecutors asked for with charges was $1 million. And what the defense asked for was release. I believe, I don't remember if it was release on a personal recognizance.
I think it was
or
home detention.
Electronic home monitoring. Right, yeah, there you go. And part of what the defense brought up in court was the lack of criminal history. What prosecutors brought up in asking for the $1 million bail is, even though this was the first case that was referred to King County prosecutors, the severity of it and the risk to the public. And so that's where it's a hard call for the judge, where you've got the prosecutors at charging asking for $1 million, the defense saying, hey, their request they thought was in line with court rules. That's why it's a hard call for the judge. Mm. But, you know, I think that if you asked Amy, she would say every time in a case like that, she's going to ask for a pretty substantial bail mm-hmm. when possible.
Yeah, and the judge decided that $100,000 was enough. And, you know, we don't know what's going to happen there if this man's family is going to post the bail or anything like that. But that was a question on people's mind. And I think what happens when people ask those questions, we forget about how the justice system works and the kind of justice we want to see.
Absolutely.
Right. And so, again, but we have to remember innocent until proven guilty. We do have another case out of Renton, though, that you have an update on.
There was a case last week with five juveniles out of Renton, and they were on an alleged crime spree, and King County prosecutors asked for each of them to be held in juvenile detention. Three of them were. We anticipate getting the case from Renton today for a charging decision. And one note about Renton is they've been really great with communication. They've been in touch with our juvenile division and vice versa. And we think that great communication is just going to continue. So that's really good to see. And we're going to have an update on that. We'll keep fuzzing on it.
All right. Casey McNerthy from the King County Prosecutor's Office. Thank you so much for your time.
Hey, great seeing you, Colin.
I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News.
You can hear us live every morning on 97.3 FM or subscribe to this podcast and you'll never miss the show.